Hello, good afternoon, everyone. I've been saying good morning, everyone, and that no longer is relevant. My name is Julia Herz. I'm the Craft Beer Program Director at the Brewers Association. Super psyched to see you guys give time to this very worthy and important topic. Most of you that are members from the BA, or if you're not, you should know, the Brewers Association, in our technical world and technical efforts on behalf of small and independent craft brewers and, frankly, bettering the beverage of beer and the brewing community, has what I call a triangle of emphasis on the technical side. In quality was heavily mentioned on the main stage today, and you also have sustainability, but you third on that triangle is safety. And Matt Stinchfield has been our ambassador now for Tour of Duty. How many fingers was that? Three, his big fingers. And that is 3 years that we are all the better because of that time. He spent many hours and road miles traveling the country talking to craft brewers and giving different versions of presentations. So I just want to commend you guys, give yourselves a pat on the back for taking safety seriously and taking part of your conference to focus on this very important topic. So we are about to dive into Brewery Burns. And with that, I am proud to introduce the ambassador for safety to the Brewers Association, Matt Stinchfield.
Thanks, Julia, and I'll echo Julia's sentiment. I appreciate you coming out for this. Not necessarily a happy topic. I'll do my best to put in a couple of dry jokes. So they are jokes. It's okay. You can laugh. I don't want you to get burned. Burns hurt. They're extremely painful. They last a long time. People can die from burns. They're tremendously slow to heal, and they also burn your spirit. They burn you psychologically as well, and they're difficult to come back from. And probably the least important thing on this list right here is that burns cost a business a lot of money. There are many kinds of burns, many causes of burns. Some of the burns I'm going to highlight for you today are so peculiar, you imagine, how could that strange thing have happened? And I'll follow it with another strange thing that happened, because burns sneak up on us in a lot of different ways. They do cause a long-term problem for your workforce, especially in a very small brewery, because one of your most important players is down and out as that happens. It bears mentioning that people who've been burned often understand it after the fact as something that they did to contribute to the incident and are therefore embarrassed by it. But today we're going to talk about how burns are preventable and how there are some really great, thanks, super, Julia, and how burns are preventable through a series of different kinds of actions that we can call safe work practices, engineering controls, and personal protective equipment. I said cost is probably the least important reason to avoid a burn, so I'm going to get that one out of the way first. This is drawn from OSHA's data, national burn injury averages, so not just for breweries, but for other types of work where people have been burned, that the average direct impact in cost, $37,000, on a worker's comp side. So treating the emergency treatment and subsequent treatment of burns, averaging $37,000. Imagine what somebody who spends 6 months in a burn unit is costing. The indirect cost that the employer pays averages about $41,000, and so before any fines are levied or any insurance premiums change, you're looking at $78,000 on average for a burn. And if your brewery's operating at a 25% gross sales margin, you've got to sell over $300,000 worth of beer just to make up for the financial impact here. That's not counting OSHA fines, which for serious violations are now have a minimum of $12,000. Workers' compensation, EMRs, that's experience modification rate, that's the multiplier on your premium. It's a three-year rolling average. So if you had a bad year and somebody was seriously injured and your workers' comp premiums went up as a result of that, you're going to be paying that number for 3 years. And if you've got good behavior and you haven't hurt anybody seriously over those 3 years, you might be able to get it back down a bit. This can add up to, from tens of thousands of dollars a year for a small brewery to hundreds of thousands of dollars for a mid-sized brewery. Okay, so in today's talk, what I'm going to focus on first is what is a burn? What is a burn from the medical standpoint? And what is a burn from the brewer's perspective? we're going to look at the root causes of burns, because if we don't understand how burns occur, we can't avoid them. And that's really what our end game today is, to get to the place where we can say, I know how that can hurt me in this way, and my mitigation strategies are these, and therefore I'm putting those into operation, and now I'm safer. Never 100% out of the woods, folks, but safer. We're going to talk about the importance of hazard assessment. I'm going to be coming back to the idea of hazard assessment 3 or 4 times during the talk today. And the result of hazard assessment is the development of avoidance strategies. In other words, protective and preventative strategies that you can use to not get burned. And I'll finish with some rather sobering synopses of burns that have been experienced by brewers, some of whom you probably know. There are a few burn pictures in my slide presentation. I want to let you know I have vetted them so that they're not especially gruesome, but even a minor burn of second degree is pretty tough to look at. So what is a burn? From a medical standpoint, it's tissue damage caused by rapid heating or chemical action on tissue. And if you think about skin and your composition of your body as being made up of 3 layers, the epidermis, which is the thing above the dermis, which is the living tissue that has a lot of blood flow in it, nerve endings, and so forth. And below that, musculature and skeletal system, right? Deep tissues. And when doctors talk about a burn, they talk about the area that was really highly heated as the zone of coagulation. I'm telling you this term because it just sounds disgusting to me. And in fact, what's happening is cell walls are breaking down, and the liquid matter that's in cells, because we're mostly water, aren't we? Hence the term the zone of coagulation. Around that is a zone of stasis where there's some tissue damage, and if it's in the upper surfaces, if it's in the epidermis or a little bit in the dermis, we heal from that. We can recover from that. The tissue in the zone of coagulation is fried. Below that, outside of that, we have an area that's being stressed, but that's healable. And if you look down on the lower left diagram here, you'll see where after a burn, the treatment that was affected on it was proper and timely. And so the zone of stasis remains preserved, and the actual impact area in the coagulation zone is minimized. But in a burn that's not treated properly, tissue continues to die. The zone of coagulation expands, and the stasis zone diminishes, making the injury get worse over time. You're going to hear more about this sort of latent burn injury as we go. Burns are really a transfer of energy, whether it's thermal energy or chemical energy or electrical energy. It's energy that is being absorbed by your tissues, and to a point at which the tissues are breaking down. So obviously, the more energy that's involved, the higher temperature material, the larger quantity of material, or the duration, how long is it? Is it, you know, an instantaneous steam burn because my forearm's over the kettle manway and I go, ow, you know, that's a superficial burn. Maybe I'll figure that out one day, not to do that again, you know? But on the other hand, we have burns that are not superficial because the duration is long. And wart boilovers are a tough one because wart is hot and sticky, has a high heat capacity, and gets in our clothes and on us. And the duration is quite long, and it stays hot for a long time. So obviously, we've got damage to the skin cells, but the skin, especially in the dermis, we've got capillaries and we've got nerve endings. And so we're getting nerve damage from that. In many cases, skin grafting is a result. And if you don't know what that is, that's where they take some good skin from your backside or someplace that didn't get hit in the burn, and they apply it to the burn zone after the burn has undergone quite a lot of intermediate treatment and care before they're ready to do that, right? We've got to go restore blood flow to the epidermis, to the dermis, and be ready to have the skin graft take. And as I mentioned, there are also psychological scars in addition to the physical ones. And there is something called systemic effects, which I want to talk for a moment about. Typically, if about a third of the body is burned, in a serious burn, I'll just throw out the term second and third degree for us right now, the body sustains systemic effects as well. Now, I'll get to that in just a moment, but first, here's just a little bit better diagram. What we typically call, you know, as lay people call a first-degree burn, somebody in the medical business might refer to this burn is of superficial thickness, because it's not really like there's only 1, 2, and 3 degrees. There are graduations between it, and they can say, well, at this part of the body, the impact was superficial, and then, you know, but here we had some deep partial thickness. And then in a third-degree burn where the tissue is destroyed and either charred black or charred white, we've got the widespread systemic response, and we've got parts of the body that just don't have the ability to grow back in healing. So the much more complicated treatment there. In general, a burn of superficial nature is usually just a redness on the skin and some pain. In a deep partial thickness burn, we often see blisters, but, you know, not necessarily. And in the full thickness burn, you're going to see some grotesque discoloration that can range from black to white and everything in between. These systemic effects, systemic is a term that refers to things that aren't at the local point of injury. So your digestive system, your circulatory system, your respiratory system, your nervous system, these are systems of the body. And so when those things are affected, we say we have had a systemic effect. And one of the body's natural reactions to a burn is to release anti-inflammatory mediators into the body to try to control, right? Like if you twist your ankle swells up, right? That's an immune response or a bodily response to twisting your ankle and tearing tissue there. Well, in the case of a burn, the body tries to keep inflammation reduced because inflammation is sending fluids to the injury site and you're leaking there. Sorry to be blunt about it. And so the body has a mechanism to try not to inflame. As a result of that, we get vasoconstriction, we get respiratory bronchial constriction, we get an increase in our metabolic rate because all the blood flow is reduced down to tight capillaries. And then the heart is struggling, okay? But at the same time, it's not squeezing as much as it normally squeezes. And so in some cases of, deep tissue burns, over 30% or more of the body, the individual might be 2 months in the hospital and then find themselves struggling to stay alive because the organs are damaged and the kidneys can't keep up with what kidneys do and the liver isn't making enough glycogen and the heart's not pumping enough blood and therefore not enough oxygen. These are just some of the things that happen with the systemic effects of burns, and you'll notice the last one is probably the most concerning. It gives you reduced immune response. So you're much more subject to infection in this, you know, in your open wounds. So very tough stuff to get into. All right, now let's start to get our head around how these horrible things can happen, because I hope by now you realize you don't want your tissue to undergo this effect. The first thing we want to do is do something called a hazard assessment process. And the reason that many burns occur in breweries is because brewers, frankly, don't know the hazards of what they're working with, or they don't appreciate the magnitude of those hazards. Okay? And I'm going to go through this many times in my talk, but the hazard assessment in very short form is you think about a task and you think about all the steps in that task. And then for each step, you say, what hazards could exist at this stage of the game? All right? I'm running wort into the kettle. What could happen? I could open the wrong valve and get 170-degree wort from the Lauterton on my foot. That's one. And then you systematically go through, all the way through, and you make a little laundry list. And you organize those hazards by step, and you think about them by, you know, how likely are they? And if they do occur, what could happen to me, and how severe could it be? What's the duration of a burn that occurs from putting my elbow over the steam coming out of the kettle versus what's the duration of falling into a vessel that's 180 degrees. Okay, two totally different situations there. So in terms of severity. And once you've made this list of the hazards that you could encounter, you counter each hazard by saying, I think for that problem with the valve running out the hot wart on my foot, one thing I'm going to do is I'm going to make sure I'm wearing appropriate pants and boots for the job. And then I'm going to make sure that procedurally we know that that valve is always closed before we begin to collect runoff. Those are two steps that help reduce the opportunity for the hazard of hot work going on my foot to occur in the first place. It's that simple. Most of these things don't actually cost a penny. They're strategic. This is where Zen comes into safety, right? I mean, if you could make your life totally safe and not spend anything to do it and avoid all hazards, right, that would be some kind of an amazing place to be. And you can get yourself there gradually, one step at a time, by this hazard assessment process. But let's say you know that you're supposed to be utilizing certain hazard controls and you're not using them. That's kind of a human factor thing, you know. I say ignorance. The root of ignorance is the word ignore, right? You know better, you decide to not take it seriously, and you get hit. So those hazard controls are preventative and protective steps that you can put into place that are going to help reduce the opportunity for those hazards to get you. You're going to create standard operating procedures, which, and I say this every time I talk about safety, SOPs relate to quality as well. And so the replicability of your process and the quality of your product can only improve when you start thinking about safety and you start thinking about developing written procedures. Even very small breweries should be doing this. And we all know in this business, we're rushed, we're hurried, we don't have enough manpower, girl power, we don't have enough material, we don't have enough time in the day, we're tired, sometimes we just give up and we take shortcuts, or we're in the middle of bringing our wort to a boil and we have to load the distributor's truck. Because we're the only one there. Distraction. It happens. Work to avoid these things as much as you can. And then there are certain things that you're doing consciously or unconsciously that are really scary. We're going to talk about this with wort boilovers, exceeding design specs. Trying to, you know, I understand that. That's an extra barrel of beer, you know, and it's the same amount of labor. We'll be a little more profitable on this batch if we can knock out 18 barrels instead of 17. But be careful because, you know, one boil over that gets you and you've lost everything you've gained by knocking out an extra barrel every batch. Standing in the line of fire, not knowing how to open a manway, for example, to avoid the potential if it were to be foaming over when you opened the manway. Okay? Or steam contact, etc. Balance, traction, grip. Good fitting, not rushing, walking, not running. Avoiding trip hazards because you've got good housekeeping in the brewery, all that good stuff. Okay, so I'm going to come back around to this now. This is this lovely little tool here that the Brewers Association Safety Subcommittee created is a little hazard placard reminder that outlines different kinds of hazards that you're going to experience in a brewery. It's very general, but I've highlighted here in green temperature hazards, electrical hazards, pressure hazards, flammability hazards, and corrosive hazards, because those are all things that can result in a brewery burn of one type or another. And I've got a stack of these right up here, and so afterwards I want you to come get one of these and really sleep with it under your pillow, read it at night. On the back side, the five steps of hazard assessment simplified for you here. Every job in the brewery, you should have gone through the mental exercise of thinking about what are the hazards, what are the procedures to avoid encountering those hazards, put it in an SOP, you're going to love it. I know somebody else says that. I shouldn't have said that. All right. So here we are. Again, the five steps. You walk through the task, you look to see where are the hazards, and if you're looking for burn hazards, you're going to find something else. You're going to find a housekeeping problem that results in tripping hazard, or in one case, somebody put their foot in a trench with a hot caustic solution running through the trench. So you're going to say, well, this housekeeping hazard is related to the burn hazard, and we'll kill two birds with one stone by putting the floor, the grates on the drain. And then again, classify those by their severity and their type, and then come up with a plan to solve them. I'm going to tell you what those hazard controls are, or give you examples for each kind of burn here. So let's go through the types of burns we're going to talk about today. Thermal burns, and I'm going to break out four little hazard analyses for you, hazard assessment projects, one on scalding liquids, not quite boiling, one on boiling liquids, one on steam, and one on direct contact with extreme temperature surfaces. We're going to look at chemical burns, both from the corrosive side and also from oxidizing sanitizers. They're effectively managed the same way. Your job hazard assessment for those is almost identical. And we'll talk about electrical burns. Electrocution is a fatality caused by current running through your body. There are electrical burns and electrical shocks that are less than electrocution, right, where one does not die. And there's something called arc flash, which I'll show you a little video about. And, of course, don't forget Robert Burns, the great poet from Scotland. And why am I bringing this up? Because he's famous for saying there is no such uncertainty as a sure thing. And when we're talking about safety and controlling hazards, we're always dealing with a sort of a probability aspect. And what I hope you take from today's talk are ways to reduce those probabilities. Okay, so again, hazard assessment. Here's how I'm going to show you. I'm going to jump one slide ahead. This is what we're going to do. We're going to look at a hazard, hot water contact, and we're going to look at how does it happen, what is its severity, its likelihood, and what are some hazard controls for it. So again, this is the generic approach that we're going to do here, and it agrees with what's on the hazard assessment cards that you can take at the end of the talk. It's a description of the principal hazard that's involved in the task. What is that hazard? How does it occur? How long does it impact me? How severely does it impact me? And is it pie in the sky, super rare, one in a million? Sometimes one in a million is enough, you know, to be concerned about. Or is it more like a one in 10 hazard? And then hazard controls. What are hazard controls? They are sometimes equipment, and they're sometimes ideas. They're sometimes just the way we do what we do. Safe work practices are the most zen of all of them, right? There's boiling hot liquid spraying out of that vessel. I'm going to move away, right? Now I'm that much farther away from it, provided that I didn't get hit in the time that it took me to think about getting away, in my reflex time, and provided that I didn't fall off the brewer's deck and break my legs doing it, right? But if I can avoid the hazard by just the way I behave, then I haven't spent any money, I'm improving my day-to-day working conditions, and I'm becoming more professional in every day that I do this job. And I think that's a worthy pursuit. Administrative controls have to do with things that are written, signpostings, training materials, warnings on hot pipes, that sort of stuff. You know, administrative controls are about as good as traffic signs tell us what speed to be driving. We regularly look at that, and then we make our own decision about how fast we're going to go. All right? And if we see too many signs, we get overloaded, and we don't know what to do. So sometimes they're helpful, sometimes not so helpful. Engineering controls are usually equipment strategies that help reduce the opportunity for the hazard to show its ugly face. And there are a couple of engineering controls that are helpful for burn reduction. And personal protective equipment, the gloves, the hat, the eye protection, the apron, chemical protective work boots, proper long sleeve shirt and long pants outside the boots, all that good stuff. But it's PPE. It's the last thing that's closest to your body. If it fails, you're going to get some degree of exposure. But if you choose good working clothes, you'll get less exposure than if you're in cargo shorts and Tevas. So I'm urging you right now, get past that. It's not you against the man. If you're wearing Tevas and cargo shorts, it's you against yourself. All right, so here's how we're going to do it. I'm taking you on a quick drive through all of these different types of burns and a mini hazard assessment. So you can do these for yourselves, and the slides will be available after the conference so you can download the presentation. The hazard with hot water contact. You know, from about 140 degrees up, we can sustain a burn. Oftentimes in a brewery, it comes from a failure of fittings, a crack in a hose, using a worm clamp that's finally eroded into the hose. You know, get the proper spray heads, get the proper worm clamps. It's a little bit more expensive than what you buy at Home Depot, but it's a whole heck of a lot safer. And there can be mistakes where you just open the bottom of your hot liquor tank and fill your boot full of, you know, 180 degree water. And so, you know, ultimately these things are either low-cost equipment fixes or they're just behavioral things that you need to train yourself a certain way to act. Again, down here then, there's a chance of a brief exposure. It could result in first or second degree burns. And we avoid this. So here's the best part, the hazard controls. We avoid it by maintaining equipment, by having operational plans, an SOP, right? Standard operating procedure, and we've undergone training, or we talk to our coworkers and go, I'm worried about this, how do you do it? Oh, well, here, I know what you're talking about, here's how I do it, and it makes me feel safer. Share that stuff, have the safety dialogue with your coworkers and your colleagues in your state guilds. And then the last two here are personal protective equipment. They're not the be-all, end-all, but in this case, they're very important. I'm going to stay a little longer on boiling wort contact because this is a big one. First of all, we're dealing with something that's very hot, you know, from 180 degrees on up to boiling, and depending on what elevation or whether you've got a calandria and so forth, you know, you can actually encounter stuff that's half steam. I'm going to spend this slide on looking at what can go wrong that causes a wort boil over, and you'll see there are quite a lot of things, or let me say a wort boil over injury. First of all, procedurally, you know, you can try to get too much volume out of your batch, and you can overcharge your kettle. You know, every brewer here should know that they're you know, on a 10-barrel brewery, that their kettle holds whatever the manufacturer designed it for. Maybe it holds 12 and a half cold barrels or 13 cold barrels. That doesn't mean you can boil 13 barrels in it. Wort expands as it's heating up. At boiling, it's you know, it's 5% bigger than it was when it was just hot liquid. So you get that volume expansion. You apply excessive heat by not knowing when to trim the heat on the kettle, especially at the beginning stages of the boil. You're not using a foam inhibitor, or you've made some procedural error that has resulted in the gushing of hot wort. You had the wrong thing open at the wrong moment. So equipment failure, what could go on here is just the absence of having a foam cutoff switch. This is a rather simple device that as foam rises up in the top of the kettle up towards the dome, you know, they can be positioned at various areas somewhere around manway height that will trigger the steam to turn off. If you're doing direct fire kettle or electric kettle, you've got a slower response time on your heating system. So keep that in mind, right? Steam is rather, you cut the steam, the boil comes right down, unless you've got way more engineering on your boiler than you needed. There are things that we do in the way that we brew that can cause this problem. Adding hops too quickly, right? You got a big 5-gallon bucket full of hop pellets and you just go, broomp. Please, sprinkle them in. Right? I know your brew schedule says it's 60 minutes, I'm putting in this bucket of hops. It can take between 60 down to 59 minutes for you to do that, okay? You're still going to get the utilization. And one reason you're going to get it is because all the wort's going to stay in the kettle and you're not going to boil your hops out in a wort boil over. So there again, the safety problem is related to the quality problem. You're in an exposed position near the manway, or you're in what we call the line of fire. You open the manway this way, and if it's going to come out, it's coming out right here. Whereas if you open it this way, you've at least got that kind of a shield there in the form of the manway lid. Maybe there's a procedure at your brewery that we shouldn't be opening the manway at all during the kettle. Depends on the engineering of your brewery. Or you're exposed beneath the brew kettle or beneath the brew deck. So there was an incident at one brewery I know of, a mid-sized regional brewery, and they had a calandria, and as the wort was coming up to boil in the beginning, they didn't trim the calandria. So what happens is you're heating, it's going, 192, 193, 194, and then you get up around 209, 210, and all of a sudden, it starts to really move. And that's where you slow down your side jacket or your calandria. And it boiled over, they had a wort boil over, they got off the deck, they couldn't stop it, because they used a manual steam valve, which was directly underneath the deck. And so the hot wort's cascading down, and they can't get there to turn it off. So they have to let it run its course and have an even bigger, stickier cleanup to deal with. So there's an equipment damage problem there, and I think they avoided the injuries, but geez. Failure to wear the right garment, not wearing long pants, not wearing industrial boots. And if we're talking about brew house and cellaring activities, you should just be wearing chemical knee highs and then drape your pant leg over the boot. We could argue about that. It's like the people who argue against wearing a safety belt because it crinkles their tie. And I say, well, after you go through the windshield, your tie will be very crinkled. So wear the seat belt or put your tie on later. And then hand and eye protection, of course. Okay. Those are just how it can go down and how we can get hurt. Let's look at the severity. You can have an extended exposure with wort contact because it's sticky. It has a high heat capacity. It's hotter. In a sense, it has more heat in it than hot water itself. It's not inconceivable to get large contact surface area on your body with it. All right, people get it on arms, legs, torso, sometimes the face. Or filling a boot is just dandy. And these are severe burns. So what are the hazard controls? Well, before anything, let's understand that the potential exists and come up with some safe procedures which we've come up with by doing a hazard assessment process. We need to know certain things that somebody might never have taught you before. So again, increasing the dialogue with your colleagues at your own brewery or other breweries, attending training as you're doing today, those kind of things. Learn that there is the idea as you're coming up to boil in the kettle that it's going to be bad behaving for 10 or 15 minutes until it achieves hot break. And once it achieves hot break, we know that it's less foamy. So build in a procedure into your brewing process that says we go for 15 minutes and then we add the bittering charge. And if you have to change the amount of wort runoff because you've done some extra boil off in that time, that's not rocket science. You can figure that out. Cautiously add the hops. If you go back and look at wort boil over injuries, quite often you'll find somebody was brewing a big IPA or a double IPA. And there's a big bittering charge going in. Use a foam inhibitor. Before you start any of this, double check your plumbing, right? Remember, you're hurrying, you're fatigued, you're trying to do three jobs at once. Stop, take a breather, 2 seconds extra to go. Yep, closed, closed, open, closed. And I brew on a manual system that has a lot of manual valves and very little automation. And, you may have more automation and you may have some interlocks. You may have programs that you work with. That's another great hazard control. And then have established emergency procedures. If all my best efforts to avoid coming in contact with hot wort fail me and I get hit, what do I do? Well, for me, I have 7 steps to go down and about 28 feet to the shower. And I know where it is and it's kept clear because if I get hit in the face, the same goes for chemical burns, I can't see. I'm running blind to the shower. People don't think about this when they think about, we've got a shower, we're good. Not if it's in your face, you're not. Know the size of your kettle, know what real boil volume you have. Think about installing a cutoff switch if it's appropriate for you, and then selecting the right protective equipment. Okay, here we go. Guy on the left here put his foot in an open trench in the brewery in a crowded workspace with difficult housekeeping issues, working in and on top of another guy doing a different job, and the floor grates were taken out of the drain. Hot caustic cleaning water is running down the drain. He catches his balance. He slips on a hose or something, tries to catch his balance, and puts his foot right in the drain. He immediately pulls it out and gets his boot off, and that's what he's got. Direct contact with boiling liquid in the other. All right. Job hazard assessment for steam contact. Steam is hotter than boiling water. I don't know if you know that. And where do we come in contact with steam? Most often, it's at the manways to kettles and whirlpools. And this action that you see here, I think, is being fairly well done. She's approaching the manway from the safest side, being on the side of the lid. She's got rubber gloves on. I know what brewery she's at. I can tell you she's wearing eye protection. She's got her pant legs over her boots, and she's reaching out as far as she can to stay the distance from the steam as she adds the hop charge. Does the steam still exist? Yes. Does the burn injury possibility still exist? Of course it does. But she's taken every step she can here to do this as safely as you can. And some days that's all you can ask, because not every brewery has some magical hop delivery device over here that we just load hops in and it gets sent into the kettle. An unlikely source of injury here would be a steam line rupture of some sort. And, you know, if you've had a proper steam fitter in your brewery installing your steam, then you should feel pretty comfortable about that. If you're a do-it-yourselfer and you did your own steam work, again, same thing. Have SOPs. Have the physical protection of your body with protective clothing. And have properly installed equipment. Probably a less common source of injury are direct contact thermal burns in the brewery. This is a very interesting little brewery down in the Ardennes in Belgium. They actually burn wood to heat their hot liquor and their kettle. You know, can you come in direct contact with a hot door on the front of the furnace? Yes. Could you trip over that hose and put your hand in the fire? Yeah. How likely? I don't know. He's been doing it a long time. Probably has a story he hasn't told anybody. Also, you can get frostbite in a brewery, and I don't know if you know that, but in the rapid expansion of liquefied gases, fixtures get extremely cold. And if you're in a humid environment, you'll see frost occurring on regulators and so forth. But if you're in a dry environment, like if you're in Arizona, you may not actually see any frost occurring because the moisture level is so low in the air. It just looks like a regulator. Unfortunately, it's about 40 below zero when you touch it. So you can have a frostbite injury. It's a very, very quick-acting frostbite injury. And how are we going to deal with that? Good housekeeping, operational procedures, wearing some sort of skin protection that's going to be helpful for us in those hazards, and then just knowing that the hazard exists by notifying people around in the area. Hot surface contact burns. We're going to finish up a little bit with first aid, some first aid recommendations. And, running cool water on a burn is one of the best things you can do right away. On the right-hand side here, you'll see a gentleman's hand who came in contact with a liquefied gas, bare skin and liquefied gas. It took him 16 months of healing and close medical care throughout. There's definitely permanent nerve damage, and if you look closely at each of his fingertips there, you'll see a dark spot in the middle of his finger pads. So 16 months, probably not all done, probably never get full healing and full feeling back in that hand. All right, now, if I do this right, you're going to get to watch a wart boilover video, and I think we're going to have audio with this too. We'll give it a try. It worked in the green room. Wow. Well, I wonder how much they spend on hops there, for one. Number two, I noticed the rubber gloves that he should be wearing are up on top of the kettle. And again, one of those falls in the beer, quality problem. And now, if you look closely at his hand, he's not wearing the glove, right? And he thinks this whole thing is pretty funny. I'm worried for them. Okay, we're going to switch gears here to chemical burns. And first looking at a hazard assessment for acid or caustics. In chemical reactions with skin, we have the same kind of things that happen in a thermal burn in terms of destruction of cell walls, causing the release of the matter that's in cells and loss of that tissue. And fortunately, brewers don't use some of the acids that are really notorious out there for doing things like getting on you and then 12 hours later you're in deathly pain, because it soaked into down and started getting into your muscle tissue and so forth. But nevertheless, don't underestimate nitric and phosphoric and your caustic cleaners, especially when working with the principal product as you're making up a working solution. So I think the most common things here are splashes that occur from things like flopping that hose around or some kind of janky dispense system that you came up with. You might turn the barrel on its side and it has a faucet in it and you open it this way. The faucet fails and now you've got a barrel that weighs 600 pounds and you don't know what to do. Those things definitely have happened in breweries. And I'll point out that not only is caustic very slippery, but strong mineral acids are also very slippery. So even phosphoric acid, the concentrate that comes in your gallon jug or your 55-gallon drum there, that stuff on the floor is slick as oil. And therefore, you're introducing a new hazard, right? A slipping hazard that, you know, in the safety business, we say the problem with slips and trips is they lead to falls. And here you could slip and then find yourself laying in the material. And I'm not just talking about skeletal damage, but now a whole lot more of your skin contact is with the acid. It's a common possibility in breweries. It's a common exposure in breweries. The severity ranges everything from a drop of something jumped up and hit a guy in the cheek to full on, you know, I poured this on my foot and I was wearing Tevas. So, again, we can do a lot here with some simple hand, eye, and skin protection. I want to point out this scene here because this is pretty much textbook perfect. The gentleman has the appropriate hand protection on. He has long sleeve shirt. Now that's going to give him a few moments. If he got caustic on that shirt, it gives him a few moments that he wouldn't have if he had a t-shirt on. He's got a rubber apron on. He's got safety glasses on his eyes and a flip down face shield. We commonly use both of those at the same time, all right? And you can't see his boots, but he's got chemical protective boots with the pant legs outside. Also notice a nice administrative control here on the wall is the NFPA placard that shows a health hazard of 3. The maximum number here is 4. And we don't make these numbers up. They come with the product. Flammability hazard of caustic is 0. Reactivity hazard is 1 out of 4. And the ALK says it's an alkaline corrosive. If the fire department comes rushing in here, they know how to manage that particular situation. Okay, so, the severity varies according to how concentrated the material is, whether we got our clothes off in time, and washing off with plenty of water. Not scrubbing, just let the action of the water do it, and 15 or 20 minutes. I think they just... government recommendations for eye washing have just been increased to 20 minutes recently. Okay, and keep that shower handy and know how to get to it when you're blind. Same thing here with oxidizing sanitizers. The actual chemical reactions that are going on your tissue are different than an acid or a base, but they result in the same symptoms. So you're going to find that the likelihood is similar and that the hazard controls here are similar. Now, here what I'm going to do is just show you a short video clip of a hot caustic washdown in a bottling line, just so you can appreciate the force of what's going on here, and then we'll say a few more things. Great. So you see the forces that are involved here. If we didn't have, that's an engineering control, that plate glass or plexiglass window there. If that's not intact, we're in trouble, right? We're spraying hot caustic all over the place. So just think about that. Sometimes we're working with things we can't even see what's really going on, and we're just one mistake away from encountering them. I'm going to go quickly through electric shock so I can stay on time. Two kinds here, electric shock, which is where the current is passing through the body, as in the first diagram, and arc fault, resulting in an arc flash, where the current does not necessarily run through the body, but there, it causes a very, very hot incident fire. It's instantaneous. You cannot get away from it, and it shoots molten metal shrapnel into your body, and a shock wave that'll damage internal organs, throw you against a wall, and so forth. So just quickly on these two. The main electrical hazard in breweries is janky wiring, guys. So make sure you go back in and do your maintenance on your materials. Take bad stuff out of service. Use a proper electrician when it's appropriate. You can have electric shocks and burns that range anything from a tingle to burnt tissue. In severe cases of electrical burns, there's actually an entry wound and an exit wound. Right? We're made of salt water, right? So that conducts electricity. And if it went in your hand and it came out your lower back, there have been cases like this. Where did it go through? All your vital organs, right? And they sustain damage from that. And consequently, the heart failing is part of electrocution in most cases. So totally real electrocution at a brewery during just the run-up to Prohibition. Budweiser was building a St. Louis plant called the Bevo plant to make near beer and malt sugar products. And a power cord or power line fell down on a metal scaffold that had a bunch of workers on it. Eight of them got fried, and three more got serious injuries as a result of it. Now, again, totally crazy thing. Could it happen today? I can imagine it. Arc fault here, as I say, the current is jumping usually from one conductor to another, and it's using air to bridge it. How conductive is air? Not very much, but it happens. Okay, on that charming note, we're going to have one slide here on first aid for burns. And the best treatment for burns is really simple. For first-degree burns or superficial burns, run cool water over it. You can use ointments here, but first get the water on, cool the temperature of the wound. You can treat infection by putting on a tri-antibiotic salve, but this is the only type of burn that you're going to be putting anything on. And protect it during healing because the skin will be delicate. In full-thickness burns, it's a 911 call. Don't wait. Get somebody, yell to somebody, call 911, we need them now. And then apply cooling water to the injury. If the clothing is stuck, don't pull it off. But just cool water over the whole injury. Don't use any ice, ointments, don't daub cotton balls on it. The cotton will get embedded in the injury and potentially make infection worse. And don't use any of these home remedies that you'll hear about, like using butter or egg whites. Make sure you know where your first aid gear is. And lastly, I'm going to wrap up by showing you some real-life situations that happened to real brewers. A boiler exploded at one of the Boston Beer Company breweries, and the result were physical trauma injuries, burns, and potential asbestos exposure. A worker at an AB plant in Van Nuys, California, was trying to dislodge stuck hot mash coming out of, on a mash transfer, spent mash going to pipeline to their collection system, and while trying to dislodge it with his foot, ended up falling into it and got first and second degree burns on 30% of his body and was hospitalized, and it was an OSHA case, Cal OSHA case. Jeff Carlson from Tacoma, scalding mash water in his boot resulted in skin grafts, months to recover. Kerry Thomas from Idaho, wart boil over, and those systemic injuries I mentioned came back weeks into her treatment where she found herself struggling for her life. Thankfully, she's made it, and she's returned to the business. But it's tough emotionally, and she was away from work for 5 months. Nicole Ryman, I just met her yesterday. Direct superficial burns on the back of her neck from walking into unprotected hot water pipes. Adam Chandler from Oak Pond Brewing in Maine. Scow, his brewery is remote. He doesn't have good cell coverage. He often brews alone. A hose on his keg washer busted, and he was sprayed with 180-degree caustic water, had to drive himself out of the Maine woods to a hospital. These two guys at Eight Wired Brewery, well, one was a guest brewer at Eight Wired Brewery in New Zealand, making a double IPA, wart boil over. They're both up on a deck. They both jumped 2 meters, that's 6.5 feet, off of the deck, but they were both seriously burned, resulting in months away from work and skin grafts. Jimmy Vollmer of Benson Brewery in Omaha, Nebraska, wart boil over, minor contact. Terry Farrendorf, one of the most outspoken burn injury victims in our business, many years ago in the beginning of her career, filled her boot with boiling water and had to have skin grafts. You can talk to her if you're a member of the Pink Boot Society. She'll certainly talk to you about this. Mark Moynihan was in a very unusual accident that involved oxygen enrichment. He was welding a hole inside of a tank, and they knew that there wasn't enough oxygen in it, so they opened up an oxygen tank and added oxygen to the vessel. He went inside, struck his blowtorch, and immediately, in that higher oxygen content, his clothes and hair spontaneously combusted. He got himself out. He lived for 75 days in a burn unit and succumbed to systemic injuries. Please, if you know how they're caused and you know the steps that we've talked about today to avoid them, you can assess each task for its burn hazard potential. Know what those kinds of hazards are that you could encounter. Know what the likelihood or severity of that burn is, because those are the ones that need to come up top of mind for you. And then implement hazard controls, where you're going to use preventative and protective strategies. Write a procedure for each thing. It'll improve your safety, well-being, and your quality. I thank you very much. I'm happy to take a couple questions. And if you do have a question, we ask you to use the mic so that it can be on the tape. People are counting on you. Don't let us down. Thank you.
I'll throw it in since no one lined up real quick. And if I was Matt, I would use every second to be talking about this important topic. But if it's okay, Matt, I can direct them to online resources to further this conversation so you can continue your in-house advocacy in your brewery. The Brewers Association on brewersassociation.org has extensive safety resources for you. Extensive manuals. Our free online brewery safety training is robust. More than 79,000 video completions and certifications through that. This is a very strong program that Matt has contributed to, and many of the powerful safety minds have put these resources together. And then I want to let you to know that we talk about confined spaces, protective clothing, power industrial trucks, and then we talk extensively about OSHA requirements that you are legally required by law to follow. So brewersassociation.org under best practices is there for you to further this.
Thanks, Julia. That's perfect. Come on up and see me and get one of these hazard assessment cards to take with you.